What that means is, among other things, that every 29 years, Saturn passes through the magnetotail of Jupiter. And it will be absolutely fascinating someday to learn how the magnetosphere of Saturn, if it has one, we do not know if Saturn has a magnetic field or not. If it has radiation belts, they're very weak, and there's a very good reason why they may not have radiation belts, the rings. Say, if you've got four moons of Jupiter, which are capable of sweeping up a lot of particles, how about all those billions and billions of particles that make up the rings of Saturn? So Saturn may have a strong magnetic field, even if it does not have an obvious radiation belt. And it'll be fascinating to see how the magnetic field of Saturn reacts to being suddenly thrust inside the magnetotail of Jupiter and then out again. We don't get a chance to observe anything like that when the Moon passes through the Earth's magnetotail. The Moon has no magnetic field of its own. And by sheer dumb luck, it turns out that both of the Voyagers will be traveling as they go from Jupiter to Saturn practically along the Jovian magnetotail. If we are really lucky, we'll manage to get a situation, since that magnetotail wiggles back and forth, and since they're not going on exactly identical paths, where one of them is inside most of the time, and the other one is just outside most of the time. And that will be really wonderful. We'll see whether the gods are that good to us. Okay? The fourth shock I guess I'm up to now was that although this magnetosphere with its enclosed radiation belt is so enormous, the most intense part of the radiation belt is constricted along a thin sheet which lies above the magnetic equator of Jupiter. Now, this diagram is drawn incorrectly in one respect. They've got the belts there parallel to the magnetic equator, and they shouldn't be. They should be parallel to the geographic equator, which is shown here by this line labeled axis of rotation. There is a tilt, as there is on Earth. In fact, it's just about the same amount. The tilt of the magnetic axis, that is to say the line you draw between the magnetic north pole and the magnetic south pole, is about 15 degrees relative to the axis of rotation. The only difference is it's in the opposite direction. A compass needle on Jupiter would point south. So that whole thing, take the magnetic equator with that sheet of radiation belt particles along it, that whole thing is sort of like a phonograph record, which you might put on a turntable with one edge propped up an inch or so, and then turn on the turntable. And you can imagine how it would wobble back and forth every time there's a Jupiter day, which is every 10 hours. We were able to observe that wobbling back and forth during the course of the Pioneer 10 and 11 flybys. So what this means is that even though the radiation belt is more intense than anybody expected, you can get closer to Jupiter than Pioneer 10 did. The way you do it is see to it that you come in not along roughly the equator, which is what Pioneer 10 did. If anybody had known, that was the worst possible way they could have done it. Instead, come down at an angle like this, go through the intense part and be through it fast, and then make your closest approach to the planet at a high latitude, well away from the equator. Do it on the southern side because that's where the great red spot is, and of course you want to get a close-up picture of that at closest approach, and try to do it also at a time when this tilt has it up above you like this instead of coming down through you like that, as it would have a Jupiter day later. And so, Pioneer 11, which at the time was still on the way to Jupiter, was retargeted in space to make an approach three times closer than Pioneer 10 did, even though Pioneer 10 barely survived its approach. It made the kind of approach that I just described. It came within 26,000 miles of Jupiter. As it went through the most intense part of the radiation belt, it experienced a peak radiation 100 times as great as Pioneer 10 did. But its total radiation dosage was actually less than Pioneer 10 had experienced. And it too lost two instruments this time, and also had experience with false commands from the computer. But again, of course, that had been foreseen. And as a result, we were able to get that magnificent close-up picture of the great red spot that I showed you. The Voyagers are more delicate. They will not go anything like that close. The closest that they will get, in fact, is about 250,000 miles, because Voyager 1 is going to fly formation with the Moon Io for a good third of its orbit and make very detailed, prolonged studies, as prolonged as you can in a flyby, of what may be the most interesting of Jupiter's moons. Or maybe it's not. We may just be too ignorant of the others. And we know Io is interesting. It will, and Voyager 2 will go even farther out than that,
But they have these enormously powerful telescopes, and so they'll be able to get very much more detailed pictures of Jupiter, even though they are not going as close. Well, it is now 9:20 p.m., and what we're going to have at this point is a 5-minute intermission. At the end of the intermission, I will tell you about the moons of Jupiter. I've already told you some things about them, but I want to tell you some of the really incredible facts about Io and go through the others in such detail as we know. And then I'll wrap things up by telling you about the heroes of this whole story, the Pioneer 10 and 11 spacecraft themselves. Let's have then a 5-minute intermission, and that means that we'll be back at 9:25. See them from Jupiter. This is a picture of some of the moons photographed from the Earth, and two of them there are numbered in the order of their discovery. That was the old nomenclature system. All of them now have names. The other two, apparently, whoever put this slide together couldn't identify, but those are moons as well. There are 13 moons of Jupiter for sure, counting the four big ones, and there is a probable 14th, which was discovered year before last by Charles Cole, the same man who discovered Chiron. It's now been given a name, the object whose orbit is mostly between Saturn and Uranus, and which was incorrectly described widely in the media as a 10th planet last year when he discovered it. He tells me, I talked to him about Chiron, and I asked him about the 14th moon while I was at it, and he tells me he thinks there's a 50-50 chance he's going to be able to find it again this year. The reason it was lost was that he discovered it right at the end of the Jupiter observation season for that particular year, just before Jupiter disappeared behind the sun as seen from the Earth, and wasn't able to get enough observations of it to get a decent orbit. So by the time Jupiter came out from behind the sun again, no one knew how to predict exactly where to look for it, and it's an exceedingly faint object, faintest object that's ever been seen in the solar system, because it's so very tiny. Well, the moons fall into four categories, and those are Amalthea, which is the innermost. It is small, like the outer moons, and yet it has an orbit which is perfectly circular and perfectly above the equator of Jupiter, like the big moons, which are called the Galilean satellites, because they were discovered with the first astronomical telescope in history by Galileo in the year 1609. The nature of Amalthea is therefore very strange, and we have the same problem with it as we do with Phobos and Deimos, the two little moons of Mars, which are believed generally to be captured asteroids, and the Viking observations of what they're made of made us believe that even more strongly than ever. If you want to know more about that, I didn't talk about it here ever, and I don't have time to talk about it now, so you have to come down to Ann Arbor if you want the latest update on that. I'm going to talk about Phobos and Deimos tomorrow. Suffice it to say for now that they also, although they're believed to be captured asteroids, have orbits which are perfectly circular and directly above the equator of Mars, whereas if you have an asteroid that just comes in from some random direction, manages to get captured by the planet's gravity, which is an exceedingly difficult thing to arrange anyway, obviously it comes in from a random direction, the orbit that it takes up isn't going to have anything to do with the planet's equator, and almost always it is not going to be perfectly circular. In fact, there's a 50-50 chance it's going to go in one direction around the planet, or a 50-50 chance it'll go in the other direction. It just depends on the accident of which way it happened to come in. So that's Amalthea. We will get photographs of Amalthea as well as the four big moons by the two voyages. Then come the four big moons, which you've already heard some things about and are about to hear more of. Those are, in order outward, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto. The moons of Jupiter, all of them are named for various lovers, male and female, that Jupiter had. And if you know your Greek mythology, you will be aware that there is an abundant source of such names. And so we're not going to run out of moons anytime soon. However, an exception to that is Amalthea, who was the nurse of Jupiter in his childhood. And I think it's a dirty trick to have his nurse standing in there between him and all his lovers. The way they're named, though. The person who named Amalthea was Camille Flammarion in the end of the last century, and so it's a little late to argue about it. Beyond the Galilean satellites, the four big ones, there are two groups of outer moons, each of which have four members, and then number 14 is going to go into one or the other of those if and when we find it again. The inner one of those four, let's go to the next slide because that shows the orbits of these moons, and you can see that those outer moons orbit. So here's the orbit of Callisto, the outermost of the Galilean satellites, and then here are all the others, and they're still numbered by their order of discovery. You can see it's just a bewildering system. half of them do in fact go one way and half of them go the other way, and the orbits are tilted all over the place, so nobody has too very serious reservations about just assuming these are captured asteroids. The inner group are named in order outward from the planet, Leda, Himalaya, Elara, and Lysithia, and these names were just recently, 2 years ago in fact, agreed upon by the International Astronomical Union. They have an average distance of 8 to 9 million miles from the planet, and all of those go in the same direction around the planet as the planet rotates and as Amalthea and the Galilean satellites move around the planet. In other words, they have what is called a direct rotation, a revolution. If you have something going in the opposite direction, it has what is known as a retrograde revolution. The outer moons, which are in order outward from the planet, Anante, Carme, Pasiphae, and Sinope, the outermost, those four all are moving in the retrograde direction, and they have an average distance of 15 million miles from the planet, but that average distance is misleading because, as you can see from this diagram, a number of their orbits are not even approximately circular, and so they can go out as much as 20 million miles from Jupiter, as I mentioned, almost the distance from the Earth to Venus. So Sinope is or is not the outermost, depending on your definition. It's the outermost by its average distance, but there are a couple of the others that go farther out at their extremes. Same problem we have with what's the outer planet, outermost planet in the solar system. You may be aware that Pluto is the only planet whose orbit can take it inside the orbit of another planet, namely Neptune. And in fact, it is next year that Pluto is going to do this for the first time since it was discovered. And for 45 years thereafter, Pluto is not going to be the outermost planet in the solar system. Neptune is. So it depends on how you define it. Pluto will normally be considered the outermost because on the average it is. But for the rest of my professional life as a lecturer, I'm going to have to put up with little kids who correct me every time I describe Pluto as the outermost planet. And I'm not looking forward to the situation. We know very little about those outermost moons. We have never seen them as anything but dots of light. We know about their orbits and that's all. We don't know their sizes. Oh, you can estimate it very roughly from their brightnesses, but that's all, and so they're practically guesses. And unfortunately, neither the Pioneers nor the Voyagers are going to do us any good on that, because these moons are just so far apart and so tiny that it turns out it is not possible even for the Voyagers to observe any of them. Nor is it likely that the Voyagers will discover any new ones. I mean, when the thing's 20 million miles from Jupiter, what good does it have to have? What good does it do you have a spacecraft at Jupiter? You're not very much worse off if you're back on the Earth looking with a big telescope, a one that's even bigger than is on the spacecraft. So they are not going to spend any time on the Voyager mission searching for new satellites. I mention that because a few of you, I think, have heard earlier lectures in which I speculated that would happen. It's not, and I should have been bright enough to think of the reason why. What we do know about from Pioneers 10 and 11 is the inner moons, and so I want to talk about those now. There is a picture of Jupiter from the Earth, I think the first one that I've shown you. I want it in there for comparison. It's taken by Lick Observatory with their 120-inch telescope. You can see the great red spot, a little faded here. The slide is known better years. And there is Io. It looks as though it's sitting right on the planet. Of course, it should be between us and the planet, you understand. It's out in front of the planet, it's seen from us. And the sunlight is shining down in that direction, and there is Io casting its shadow on the clouds of Jupiter. Io, as you can see from this picture, is a very bright object. As a matter of fact, it is the most reflective object in the entire solar system. I would say that means it's the lightest object in the solar system, except that would be misleading. It has a color, a very distinct color. It is red, and in fact, it is the reddest object in the solar system aside from Mars. The reason for all of that was understood only fairly recently. Furthermore, Io is observed to undergo a strange behavior. It goes around Jupiter 4 times a week, once every 1.8 days, and that will again give you an idea of the strength of Jupiter's gravity, because our moon, at the same distance from its planet, takes an entire month to go around the Earth. But Jupiter's gravity is so strong that to stay in orbit at that distance, you got to do it less than once every 2 days. Io passes behind Jupiter, as seen from the Sun, once per revolution, and therefore is cut off for a few hours from the sunlight. It's very cold. When it comes out into the sunlight again, Io lights up like a neon sign for about 15 minutes, and it becomes exceedingly bright for those 15 minutes, and then goes back to its normal, still bright, but not that dazzling appearance. The reason for all this behavior has become obvious within the last few years, partly from observations from Earth, partly from observations from Pioneers 10 and 11. First of all, a question.
Kind of brightness and magnitudes,
they are all either fourth magnitude or fifth magnitude, and so since Io is the brightest of the bunch, I suppose it's fourth. The sequence of brightness goes Io, Ganymede, Europa, Callisto, like so. Callisto is the second biggest, but it's the darkest.
When it comes out from behind,
when it comes out from behind, what's the magnitude? That's a very good question, which I don't have to know the answer to offhand. Anybody happen to be able to help me out on that one? What? 17.3? That's fainter than Pluto. Yes. It's got to be brighter when it comes out from behind Jupiter. I don't know where you got that number, but you're sure not talking about this. The surface of Io would look something like this. This is a painting by Don Dixon, who was a space artist in California, not to be confused with Don Davis, who was also a space artist in California, one of those incredible coincidences that only happen in real life. And this is very accurate. This is the way that it would look. You can see Jupiter up there with a great red spot and another moon visible, but not very many stars. There is a faintly blue sky, and the ground, as advertised, is very intensely red. The blue sky is due to the fact that Io does have a very, very thin atmosphere. We do not know what the atmosphere is made of, but it was detected indirectly by observations made by Pioneer 11, which passed directly behind Io. I'm sorry, Pioneer 10 that was, which passed directly behind Io as seen from the Earth. And this is a standard way of studying the atmosphere of an astronomical object. The moment that it disappears behind the object and the moment that it reappears, the radio waves from the spacecraft are being forced to travel through the atmosphere as they go to the Earth. And they are therefore modified by that atmosphere, and you can study the atmosphere by the nature of the modification. The atmosphere of Io is extremely thin. It's only about a 20,000th as dense as the air of the Earth. So you have a nice little progression there. If you start out with the atmosphere of Venus, Earth's atmosphere is 100 times less dense, Mars's is about 100 times less dense, actually 200, and Io's is 100 times less dense than Mars. So if you just remember those and take 1% each time, you got a nice little way of remembering the various atmospheres. So you would have a very faintly blue sky. In addition, you have this intense, brilliant red surface. There was a suggestion a while ago there that Io's surface might have been so bright because it was completely covered with ice or snow of some sort. But then we realized from the Pioneer 10 and 11 observations that Io was the one that had the smallest amount of water in the whole set of four of them, and so it probably wasn't that. And besides, spectroscopic observations made from the Earth had already shown that it wasn't ice or snow. It was not frozen water of any sort. What it was, in fact, was salt. Io is surrounded, and in fact has a long, I would say, tail, except that it stretches out ahead of it, made of sodium atoms. That has got to be the strangest atmosphere, or component of an atmosphere, of any world that we know. We do not know whether the entire Io atmosphere is that gas of sodium atoms, or whether there's other stuff in there as well. But the effect of that gas of sodium atoms would do one thing that is not shown here in the painting, because the painting was made before it was known, and that is that it would turn the sky of Io very faintly yellow, which is the color of glowing sodium. As anybody knows who's seen one of these hideous sodium vapor street lamps that the cities are beginning to put in large numbers, thereby making the light pollution problem for astronomers even worse than with the mercury vapor lamps, which you thought were bad enough. Io is covered with a layer of salt. Why should it be covered with a layer of salt? By which I mean some sodium chloride, but probably mostly sodium sulfate, such as you get in some of the dry lakes out west, and there may be other substances as well. In fact, very recently it's been suggested there may be even more sulfur than there is of all these salts, though there must be some sodium or sodium's compound, or else you wouldn't have that big glowing cloud. The reason for it, apparently, was very simple and straightforward. Here is a painting by Victor Costanzo of an early epoch in the history of Io and of Jupiter. Jupiter was still hot enough that it was glowing red. You see volcanoes from inside of Io emitting great clouds of water into the sky, water vapor, and those clouds are trying to condense the water that Io had, a little of it, that it was allowed to have as it formed in the first place, is slowly coming out of the inside of the planet, and that is the origin of the water on any terrestrial planet. That's how the water on the Earth originated, for example. It hasn't been lying around those puddles all along. As I said, in the early days of the solar system's history, almost all of our water was lost, and such as we have now has come out of the inside of the planet through volcanoes and geysers and fumaroles and hot springs slowly during the history of the solar system. Io is outgassing here, but as it does so, Jupiter is heating the water. There must have been a time in Io's history when Jupiter had cooled enough that some of the water was able to form a planet-wide ocean, a liquid ocean on the surface of Io, and that makes Io the only other world besides Earth that we know of that has ever had such an ocean. But Jupiter did not allow that ocean to stay indefinitely. Slowly, probably after several tens of millions or hundreds of millions of years, Jupiter's inexorable heat boiled away the last drop of water, and so Io is left behind as you see it today. But that ocean remained on the surface long enough that it was able to leach salts out of the solid rock that Io was otherwise made of, in the same way as the water on the Earth has done and made the sea salty for that reason. And so the salt was left behind by nothing less than the evaporation, the complete evaporation of an entire global ocean. Why then is it red? Well, I remind you of the fact that Io is right in the middle of Jupiter's radiation belt. And that radiation belt is bombarding it with high-energy protons all the time. Its atmosphere is not dense enough to keep the protons away from it. Therefore, the salt is being affected by a bombardment of high-energy protons in an almost total vacuum. That sort of thing can be duplicated in the laboratory, and the result turns out to be, when you bombard sodium salts with high-energy protons, they turn red. So this was the reason for my description near the beginning of the lecture of Io as being a world that is made of rock, but is covered with red radioactive salt onto which its entire atmosphere freezes solid and falls four times a week. That is the reason for the behavior of the brightening as Io comes back into the sunlight again, and the entire atmosphere suddenly flashes from being a frozen layer lying on top of the salt into gas again. That is the most familiar of the worlds in the outer solar system. That is the one that is closest to the Earth, because it is the only one that we know of that is made of rock. And I submit that if any science fiction writer had proposed anything like that, say 30 years ago, there wouldn't have been an editor on Earth that would have accepted it as at all believable. Once again, we see that the universe is more imaginative than we are. The cloud of sodium atoms has been photographed very recently for the first time in history, and this was an exceedingly difficult thing to do. This particular photograph is a composite. That's not the actual picture they took. They put it together so that you could see what was going on. They drew in the lines, for example, which represent Io's orbit. Those were not in the original photograph. Nor was this lettering there floating up in the sky. They also put in a photograph of Jupiter at the appropriate location and scale. The little dot there represents Io itself. Io is bright enough, and the sodium cloud is faint enough. As seen from the surface, it would color the sky yellow, but it would look more or less like a rather faint aurora as seen from the surface of the Earth. So it tends to get drowned out by the brightness of Io itself. And in order to photograph it, it was necessary to put a black disk all around Io, blocking off the region around the satellite, and so you've got that black hole in the middle, which should be the very brightest part of the sodium cloud of all. What you cannot see from this picture is the shape of the sodium cloud. It turns out that, in fact, in this picture, you are looking almost along it, and it is shaped almost exactly like a banana. It also has the same color as a banana. And if you imagine taking a banana and holding it so that one end of it was pointing at your eye and you're looking along its length, I think you can imagine that you would see something very much like what you're seeing in this picture. The way that was figured out was by doing studies of this sort, in which the sodium cloud pictures are put through a computer which automatically finds contour lines of equal brightness. You do this for a number of different photographs with Io at different places in its orbit, and if you're clever enough, you can figure out what the shape of the cloud is. Here is the way the shape of that cloud goes. as Io revolves around Jupiter, and Io is moving around Jupiter in this direction. So perhaps one of the most incredible things about the cloud, which is 90,000 miles in length, in other words, a little bit longer than Jupiter itself is wide, is that it precedes Io in its orbit. It goes ahead of Io, rather than what you would intuitively expect, and that is that it would trail behind Io as it goes along. The reason for this is quite simple and straightforward, although rather bizarre. And I will show it to you here. I don't think we need to turn the slide off, and it might be worthwhile to keep it on for comparison if I just move that over a little bit. What it comes down to is that the sodium atoms are being knocked off Io, not everywhere globally across the surface, but only in roughly one quarter of the surface of the body. And that is the quarter which is trailing as Io moves around Jupiter, and the side which is toward Jupiter. In other words, the inner trailing quarter sphere of Io. If this is so, then it turns out the cloud has got to take that particular shape. I should explain that Io is known from the Pioneer observations. In fact, all four of the Galilean satellites are known always to face the same side towards their planet. So if we are talking about the inner trailing quarter sphere, we are talking about a specific geographic region on the surface of Io, a region that would be approximately the size of the United States. That region is favored for this reason. When I keep saying the sodium atoms are knocked off, and I mean that literally. The process is called sputtering in subatomic physics, and what it means is that you take a high-energy particle, in this case probably a proton, and most likely the particles are the actual particles of Jupiter's radiation belts, although there are other possibilities, and you let that particle hit some piece of matter, and it literally physically knocks off an atom or a piece of an atom from the target substance, in this case the surface of Io. Okay, what is doing the hitting? Well, here's Io, and Io is going around Jupiter in this direction. The magnetosphere of Jupiter rotates with the planet, at least in its innermost parts. We know that it does that at least as far out as Ganymede. It probably does it as far out as Callisto. It may do it farther out than that. This is referred to as a co-rotating magnetosphere. In other words, if you draw a magnetic field line, that magnetic field line is as though it were a piece of wire rigidly attached to Jupiter, and it turns around as rapidly as Jupiter itself turns, once every 10 hours. But of course, the farther out from Jupiter it is, the faster it's going in terms of miles per hour, right? If the whole thing is turning around once every 10 hours. And when you get as far out as Io is, you find that Io is moving around Jupiter at a certain speed, but the magnetosphere is moving around it more than 10 times as fast. And so the magnetospheric particles are constantly coming up on Io from behind and lapping into its rear portion. As a result of that, if the particles are magnetospheric, then they are going to be knocking into the rear side of Io, like so. And so we've explained half of this quarter sphere thing. We've explained why it should be the trailing portion rather than the leading portion. But we have not explained why it is only on this side of the trailing portion, why not over there as well. The reason for that is that this magnetic field, which Io finds itself in, moving past Io, will set up an electric potential, a voltage, across Io if Io is in any sense conducting. And it is. There's almost no question about that. For one thing, we know that it's made of rock. And rock is not a very good conductor. Ordinarily, you would not think of using it as an electronic component. In fact, ordinarily, you'd probably think of it as a pretty good insulator. But when you have an entire planet full of the stuff, and it is buried inside a magnetic field of this magnitude, there actually could be a sufficient amount of current moving through the moon to make the moon itself a conducting material. And we know that the moon itself, our moon, is able to do this because of the effect that the Earth's magnetosphere generates in it every time the moon moves through the Earth's magnetosphere. This time it's the moon moving through the magnetosphere. In the case of Io, it's the magnetosphere moving past it. But, you know, same sort of thing. It's a relative motion that's all that matters. And our rock moon actually does have a weak current that flows through it. Furthermore, Io has an atmosphere, and that atmosphere has an electronic has a charge component to it almost definitely. I mean, it does definitely. That's how it was detected. We've detected the charge component. We assume that the part that is not charged is there. In other words, it has an ionosphere. An ionosphere means a portion of the atmosphere, a component of the atmosphere, which is made up of ions, and that is the name that you give to an atom from which one or more electrons has been knocked off, so the remainder of the atom has a net electric positive charge. And we know that Io has such an ionosphere because it had an effect on the radio waves of Pioneer 10 as Pioneer 10 passed behind it as seen from Earth. Okay, so for both of those reasons, Io is surrounded by a conducting material, and Io is made of a weakly conducting material. There is an electric potential which is generated across the body and which is, in fact, 50,000 volts from one side to the other. The sense of that electric potential is that you have a negative charge on this side of Io, the side towards Jupiter, and a positive charge on the other side. The positive charge is going to repel the positively charged protons and prevent them from hitting this half of Io. However, it will attract the negative charge on the other side, will attract the negatively charged protons and cause them to hit that particular side of Io. And so now you understand why it is the side towards Jupiter rather than the side away from it that is being hit. Okay? Why then does the banana cloud have the shape that it does? Well, at this point, when I was first having this explained, which was at a meeting of the Division of Planetary Sciences of the American Astronomical Society this past December, the lecturer, who was much more of a showman than scientists usually are in scientific meetings, pulled out a banana, held it up, and said, "I have here a model of the sodium of the Io sodium cloud." And probably should have done the same thing tonight, but I was afraid somebody would eat my props. The reason for it is very simple if you understand celestial mechanics. Let me see if I can get a new section of chart that's pretty well messed up. Given that we are knocking material off this portion of a body which is moving in this direction, the material is going to leave with a velocity relative to Io something like that, correct? In other words, it is moving towards Jupiter and it is moving backwards relative to Io's motion along the orbit. Okay? The fact that it is moving backwards would seem to imply, you might think, that the material ought to trail behind Io. Maybe it should move inwards towards Jupiter, as you see that it is doing there, but it ought to go behind instead of ahead. However, you would think that only if you don't know enough celestial mechanics. If you have material that is moving inward like that, so that it is not going as fast as Io itself, right, because it's moving backwards away from the satellite, so it's not going as fast around Jupiter, what that means is that it falls into a smaller orbit around Jupiter. Okay? If this is a different diagram here, there's Jupiter, here is the orbit of Io, here is material that is moving less rapidly around Jupiter than Io, it is going to go into a smaller orbit, something like that. Okay? Because it isn't going fast enough to stay out there in that full circular orbit. Okay? What that means is it is in a smaller orbit than Io's, which in turn means that even though it is going less rapidly, it doesn't have as far to go, and it goes around that orbit faster than Io does. That is, it goes around that orbit in a shorter period of time. We have exactly the same paradox in spaceflight when you're trying to rendezvous one spacecraft with another. The whole paradox about how you speed up by slowing down and you slow down by speeding up. The net effect of it is that as soon as this material establishes its orbit around Jupiter, it is forced ahead of Io just because it is in, it's this portion of the orbit that we're interested in, just because it's in a smaller orbit. And so the sodium cloud precedes Io, it does not follow it. And that apparently is the reason for the behavior of the observed cloud.
Does this imply a small ring or disk of sodium
around? Okay, the question is, does this imply a small ring or disk of sodium all the way around that, all the way around Io's orbit and inside it? And because, of course, it can get knocked off no matter where Io is. And the answer is no. The pictures show that there is only, the brightest part of the cloud is only that banana-shaped region that you see there. There is a fainter portion which is farther out, which I'll explain in a moment. The reason for it is this. Sodium atoms are capable of glowing yellow only when they have not been ionized. okay, when they have not had electrons knocked off them. The spectrum of ionized sodium consists of emission only down in the ultraviolet. When the sodium atoms are knocked off Io, they move out at such a speed that in the first 20 hours, they cover a distance of 90,000 miles. On the average, after 20 hours, one of those sodium atoms will encounter an electron, or less frequently a proton, in the magnetosphere of Jupiter, and that electron will knock off one of its own electrons in the collision, thereby ionizing the atom. The instant that the atom is ionized, two things happen to it. Number one, it loses the ability to glow. Therefore, as soon as the sodium gets this far from Io, it abruptly becomes invisible. And the second thing is even more dramatic. It is instantly rendered electrically charged, right? Which means it suddenly becomes susceptible to the magnetic field of Jupiter. Only electrically charged particles are susceptible to a magnetic field. And the magnetic field of Jupiter, you will recall, is co-rotating at a speed of 50 miles a second, far faster than Io itself. And so the sodium atom, as soon as it becomes susceptible to a magnetic field, is suddenly picked up by that magnetosphere and accelerated instantly to a speed 10 times greater than it was going before. It remains trapped in the magnetosphere. In fact, it is now part of Jupiter's radiation belts, which you see contain a small component of sodium from this very source. So the moons are absorbing protons and electrons from the radiation belt, but Io is also injecting ionized sodium into the radiation belt. And the particle remains trapped in that co-rotating magnetosphere for many years, during all of which time it does not emit any glow, which we are capable of seeing. Eventually, it ends its ionized career by happening to collide with another electron in the radiation belt slowly enough that it is able to capture that electron. Most of the collisions are so violent that the electron simply bounce off. But finally, after several years, it deionizes itself by capturing an electron, at which point two things happen. Number one, it abruptly becomes visible again. And number two, it is still traveling at that speed, right? I mean, the magnetosphere isn't accelerating it anymore, but it's still traveling at the speed that it was at the moment that it suddenly lost its charge. That speed is far greater than the speed that is necessary to escape from the gravitational field of Jupiter at that point. And so as soon as the sodium atom, the once ionized sodium atom, deionizes itself by capturing the electron, it is hurled out of the magnetosphere of Jupiter. It escapes from Jupiter entirely and eventually becomes dissipated into the interplanetary gas. So Jupiter is not surrounded by a donut of brightly glowing sodium, but it is surrounded by a very, very large, very, very faint disk of faintly glowing sodium, which consists of sodium atoms that are on their way out of the Jovian system. That disk is too faint for anyone to have photographed so far. However, it has been detected spectroscopically, and here is a map of it. What they've done is made spectroscopic observations at four different distances from Jupiter. R sub J means the radius of Jupiter, which is 43,000 miles. So at 5.5 Jupiter radii, just inside Io itself, at 11 Jupiter radii, 22 and 34, the cloud, this all is drawn to scale, the cloud has a thickness, the disk has a thickness as shown by these lines. And so what you have is a large cloud, a disk which is shaped like this and has a hole in the middle where Jupiter itself is. I think it's one of the most incredible stories in the entire solar system. We just don't know any other worlds that have atmospheres like that. In many respects, this sodium atmosphere of Io, which may or may not be all there is to the atmosphere of Io, in fact, as I'll show you in a moment, there are at least minor components of two other substances, that sodium atmosphere of Io is more like the tail of a comet than like a normal planetary atmosphere, except for this weird behavior that it leads instead of trails. But of course, the comet tail can lead as well under the right conditions when the comet is moving away from the sun. So it's a strange sort of thing. But there is more to it than that. Other observations, spectroscopic so far, no photographs, have shown that in addition to the sodium cloud, which is shown here incorrectly because this diagram was painted before the actual photographs of it had been made, the length of it is just about shown correctly. There is Io, and here is its orbit around Jupiter. This is something called the flux tube, which I'll get to in a minute. That's not a material substance. And in addition to that sodium cloud, which is leaving Io, there is an enormously larger cloud of hydrogen, which is trailing Io and stretches halfway around its orbit. We do not know where that hydrogen comes from, and we do not know why it is that it trails Io, whereas the other one leads it. Hopefully we'll get some elucidation of that as Voyager 1 is able to fly formation with Io over one-third of its orbit. And of course, on the way in and the way out, it will pass through both of those clouds. Question?
Yeah. With Io, with all these electrical charges working, and it rotates, revolving around Jupiter, in a magnetic field of that strength, don't we have kind of a generator effect?
We do indeed. Question is, with all this electrical effect happening and Io moving around Jupiter, don't we have some sort of, in a magnetic field, don't we have some sort of generator effect? And the answer is absolutely yes, and that is probably, I swear I didn't plant this guy, but he is asking exactly the questions which I was going to talk about next, you know, in these slides anyway. As you see, I have the slides all ready for them. Well, that's because, you know, you're thinking exactly the way that the people have as they've studied Io. And it is the probable explanation for one of the most incredible facts about Jupiter. I think by this time you can see there's an awfully long list of incredible facts about Jupiter. And one of them is that that third class of radio emission that I talked about, the decametric bursts, is turned on and off by the position of Io in its orbit. Those bursts are so intense that they are definitely coming from Jupiter itself. We can tell that from the radio astronomical observations made from Earth. And we know for sure that those bursts are coming from Jupiter, and yet that each one of them is produced by something in Jupiter's atmosphere that has the intensity of several hydrogen bombs going off at once. Tens of thousands of them have been recorded by now, and yet somehow it is the position of Io, a quarter of a million miles away in its orbit, which is able to switch them on and off. In other words, whenever a particular longitude of Jupiter has rotated around so it's facing us, and Io happens to be in a particular position in its orbit relative to the Earth, we get these bursts. Almost always you can predict them that way. The bursts are so intense that you can pick them up here on the Earth, half a billion miles away, with a transistor radio. If you have one that has the correct wavelength band, they are decametric, and that is what is called the short wave band in radio terminology. Well, we think what causes them, or at least some people think what causes them, this is still controversial, is a mechanism something like this. Io is electrically charged, and therefore it is possible for electric current to flow across it. one edge of Io, and there is some line of force from Jupiter's magnetic field which happens to stretch across the other edge of Io, and you can have particles traveling up one line of force, like so. You could also have particles traveling down the other line of force, like so. They could also be traveling equally well in the other direction, but if they're traveling in the other direction, there is nothing to get them across that gap between the two lines of force. And one of the well-established rules of electrodynamics is when you have magnetohydrodynamics, actually is what this is called, when you have subatomic particles traveling along a line of force, they got to stay on the line of force that they're on unless you have some way of moving them physically from that line of force to some other line of force. And you've got such a way. That way is Io itself, which is electrically conductive, and or which is surrounded by an ionosphere, which is electrically conductive. So Io literally closes the switch between these two lines of magnetic force. And at the other end, there is also a switch that they can flow across, and that is the ionosphere of Jupiter itself. I haven't mentioned it, but of course it has one. I say of course because it's got everything else. Why shouldn't it have an ionosphere? All right? So you literally have, incredibly enough, through what you might naively have thought of as empty space, you literally have the capability of an electric circuit traveling back and forth between Jupiter and Io, like so. We don't understand all the details of this. For one thing, we don't understand exactly what it is that is doing the conducting down there at Io, whether it is really the moon itself or whether it's the ionosphere or both. For another thing, it must be this place in the ionosphere where the magnetic lines of force are closest together and therefore the field strength is strongest, and also where these particles are beginning to crash into the upper atmosphere of Jupiter. It must be there that the bursts are taking place. But exactly what it is that produces them and what is magic about certain longitudes of Jupiter and so on is not understood. It is undoubtedly significant, however, that the longitude of Jupiter, which is the one that gives rise to the greatest number and most powerful of the bursts, is the longitude such that, remember that Jupiter's magnetic field is tilted? Okay, that means that as Jupiter rotates, and the place where the lines of force are hitting Jupiter's atmosphere is more or less a constant magnetic latitude, as Jupiter rotates around an axis that is tilted with respect to the line, to the magnetic field, the place where the lines of force come down and hit is going to be those two lines of force, the two edges of the flux tube, right, the tube of lines of force which happen to hit Io at the other end, those places are going to be farther apart where the field is weakest at the foot of the flux tube, closest together where the field is strongest at the foot of the flux tube, and the longitude where the bursts are most intense and most prevalent is just the longitude at which, when the flux tube foot hits it, the magnetic field is weakest, therefore the field lines are farthest apart, therefore the particles penetrate most deeply into Jupiter's atmosphere before they are able to close the switch and move across. Okay? Some fairly advanced electricity and magnetism we just threw at you there, and I don't know if everybody was happy with it, so please ask me any questions if you're not. I see one hand back there very dimly. Please. There would be another flux tube, the other half of the flux tube, which is down here and is hitting the southern hemisphere and has not been drawn for simplicity. Absolutely. Okay. This is one line of force here, and this is the other line of force there, and there are an infinite number of lines of force in between, of course, and those are what define the edge of the flux tube. The particles can travel in either direction along the line of force. It just depends on the direction that they spiral. However, if they're going, a particle which goes up this way is going to be repelled, if it's an electron anyway, by this negative charge, rather than being zipped across. And so Io will not close the switch, except for ones that are going in this direction and going across there and back down in that direction. Does that answer your question? I'm not quite sure what it was that you were confused about. That answers it? Great. Okay, we got two questions here, and I think you were a fraction of a second earlier.
With these kind of charges, 400 kilovolts, these kind of charges...
Oh boy, I remember the number wrong. I told you 50,000 volts, 400,000 volts.
Yeah. Those kind of values on the surface of a planet that's covered with salt.
Mm-hmm.
Can we ask any questions about piezoelectric effects?
You can ask all kinds of questions about what that voltage does to Io, and I have done so, and you don't get any decent answers because we just don't know enough about where the charge is. See, for one thing, Maxwell's equations tell you, those are the equations that determine the behavior of electricity and magnetism, tell you that if you have a charged spherical body and you put up a potential across it, you can get a current flowing on the inside, but that current itself will induce a set of charges on the surface of the body, and it'll build up until that induced set of charges exactly cancels what is causing the current. Thereafter, you're safe. And that is why, this is true whether it's a spherical body or not, and that is why you are safest in a thunderstorm inside some closed metallic container, such as an airplane flying right through the heart of the thunderstorm. You'll get hit by lightning all the time, but the charges will stay on the outside, and the current will not penetrate. Or if you're in an automobile, sometimes people say the reason that you're safe in an automobile is that the lightning cannot jump across the rubber tires. That's garbage. It's just gone through a mile of atmosphere. It's not going to get stopped by 4 inches of rubber. It's the fact that you're inside a Faraday cage, which is the name for a closed conductor of that sort. But if the conductor is surrounded by another conductor, then you can have a current flowing through it or across it. So the ionosphere is absolutely essential to this model, but that's okay because the one thing that we know is that Io does have an ionosphere. Okay? And again, I don't know if that answered your question, but, tell me. An omelet silence.
What happens with a planet covered with salt,
and, you know, would you feel anything of that current and so forth down there at the surface? We just don't know, because we don't know the extent to which the current is actually going through the planet versus the extent to which it's going around it via the ionosphere. Okay, Voyager 1 is going to fly directly through the flux tube of Io. All right? So, we will have your answer for you, I suspect. We'll know much more about what is going on there anyway. Now, please help me understand, too, I would not be fair to James Warwick, the investigator on the planetary radio astronomy, the principal investigator of the planetary radio astronomy experiment on Voyager, which is the first time that a planetary spacecraft has ever been flown with radio astronomy equipment on board. So we'll get observations of these decametric bursts from around the side and be able to compare them with observations being made at the same time from the direction of the Earth. Wouldn't be fair to him. He was the one who explained all this stuff to me in the first place, and he explained it because he was a nice guy, but he also explained that he doesn't believe it. He doesn't think this is the whole answer. He suspects very strongly it's only a minor part of the answer, because we get bursts from times when this model would not suggest that we get them, and there is evidence that we get them from a much larger region of Jupiter than this narrow portion that is occupied by the foot of the flux tube. Furthermore, it turns out the model is in good agreement with the frequencies that you would expect if the flux tube is right there, and it turns out that from the intensity of the magnetic field, which in turn you get from the narrowness, from how close together the lines are, you can calculate what the frequency ought to be. The frequency is in good agreement up there in the northern hemisphere, and it is in lousy agreement down there in the southern hemisphere. That may be the other reason why the artist hasn't painted the other half of the flux tube. I don't know. So there may very well be more to it than that, and he thinks there is something even more complicated, which I don't even pretend to understand. He tried his best to explain it to me, but there were limits to what he could do over the phone without being able to wave his arms. He thinks that there are hydromagnetic waves coming out from Io, and if that means something to somebody in the audience, I'm afraid it doesn't mean anything to me. But I jumped straight to the foot of the matter, and I said, you know, so far it's a theory. I'll learn about what they are if it turns out to be a fact, because I needed to give lectures. In the meanwhile, it's a theory. I said, if these hydromagnetic waves exist, are the Voyagers, is Voyager 1 going to be able to detect them as it flies past Io and encounters it from various directions? And he just gave me a flat yes. So we are presumably going to find out about that, too. Voyager is doing a good job on Io. There was a hand. Oh, you were next, I think.
Okay, I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
First one is, now, with this flux tube, what is this doing to Jovian magnetic field itself?
No, wait a minute. The flux tube is simply part of the Jovian magnetic field. The flux tube is defined as the edge of the sheaf of imaginary magnetic field lines which happen to hit Io at any given moment. And remember, Io is moving through the magnetosphere, or rather, the magnetosphere is moving past Io, so the lines of force which define the edge of the flux tube right now are not the same as the lines of force which defined it 10 minutes ago. Okay? At any given moment, you're having these currents going back and forth, and they travel a lot faster than either the rotation of Jupiter or the motion of Io, and so it can still happen. They're traveling at a good fraction of the speed of light, as electric currents do. Incidentally, something else which you may or may not be aware of, I was not, despite having taken a number of physics courses, which, you know, tell you everything except physics. They tell you how to solve equations, basically, but they never bother to tell you what the equations are about. And Warwick had to explain this to me, so you may not be aware of it either. That is, you can have an electric current, in fact, you usually do have an electric current, in which it is not the self-same electron that goes around the entire loop. The electrons that you are getting through your finger if you stick it into a light socket are not the same electrons which left the generating plant tens of or hundreds or whatever it is of miles away. A current can consist of simply a charged particle which moves along for a certain distance and then takes a rest, but in doing so knocks off another charged particle, sort of like relay runners in a relay race becoming exhausted but passing on the baton before they stop. And so you could have a current through Io which is not of the self-same electrons which are moving up and down the magnetic field lines. They're simply forced to go across by the fact that those electrons are nudging them from behind, nudging them electrically from behind. And that made me feel a lot better, because I just found it a little bit hard to swallow that you had actual electrons moving completely through an entire moon 2,000 miles across. But you don't, not anything like it. They don't move an inch through that moon, an individual electron. I thought I saw a hand in the murk back there. Yeah.
Wasn't James working on a theory through the magnetic flux lines to convert that into radio waves to get back to Earth?
Convert what into radio waves?
To harness the energy and convert it into radio waves.
Wow. You mean for peaceful purposes of some sort? I suspect if he was, it was before we discovered how intense the radiation belts are. I'm afraid we aren't going to be solving our energy crisis by that means for a long time. I think space colonization is a better way to do that. Space-generated solar. Other questions before we go on? Yeah?
Is this electrical phenomenon is then unique to Io then, right?
That's a good question. The question is this unique to Io? And I asked that to Warwick, and I said, listen, there are flux tubes that hit Ganymede and Europa and Callisto as well. And he said, yeah, but they're made of different substances for one thing. I'm sorry, he didn't say that at all. He pointed out they're made of different substances, and then he said, and those substances are quite likely conducting, particularly Ganymede, which ought to be just beautiful, because Ganymede is full of liquid water in which there should be small amounts of ammonia dissolved. And if there is one thing that is a better conductor than ammoniated water, I don't know what it is, you know. So he pointed out that one of the weaknesses of this theory is that you ought to be able to see an obvious correlation between the motions of the other moons and the decametric radio bursts, and you don't. Now, there's a confusion there, and that is that the moon's motions themselves are not independent of one another. They have adjusted each other's positions from Jupiter by their own mutual gravitations until you have commensurabilities of their periods. That is to say, one of them goes around a certain number of times in a given time period, and another one goes around an exactly integral number of times in that same time period, so they keep repeating the same configurations with respect to one another. And so the problem is, Io and Europa have an especially good commensurability, and if you thought you found a Europa correlation, that is, you were naive and you looked in the data and you said, hey, every time Europa is here, there's a burst. It could be, just because every time Europa is here, Io is here, and that's why there's a burst, you see. With Ganymede, it's not quite as bad, but it turns out that we haven't got quite enough decades of data to really be able to separate out the effect. So that is a very good question to which the answer is we don't know yet, and it's very highly controversial. People have even tried to get a correlation with Amalthea, the little bitty inner one, and that's most people who have been in this game for very long don't believe that, and after all, Amalthea is an awful small body compared to the others. Other questions? Okay, let's move on to the other Galilean satellites then. And here are pictures of them, the best pictures that we have. This is going to be the last slide that I'm going to show because we're getting awfully late into the night. I promised a little pep talk about Pioneers 10 and 11, and I'm going to give you only a very, okay, this will be the next to last slide I'll show. I'm going to give you only a very, very abbreviated version of that. I'm sorry to do that because I love those spacecraft, and I'm anxious that they not be forgotten and drowned historically in the glare of Voyager. You know, of course the Voyagers will do much better, but let's remember Pioneers 10 and 11 were first. But
We're just not going to have time for that. These are all of them. These are not to scale. Callisto is actually the second biggest of the bunch. And these, of course, they're lousy pictures. I mean, you can't see anything on those smaller than a few hundred miles across. But they are the best pictures that we have, and they are infinitely better than we have from Earth, where all four of these moons are simply dots of light in our best telescopes. Those are the extremely computer-processed versions of the very best pictures that were taken by Pioneers 10 and 11. All four of those were taken by Pioneer 11, except for Callisto, which is Pioneer 10. And you just barely get a hint that there is structure on those. And of course, if this were like the Earth's moon, I would say, all right, that dark feature there on Ganymede is a mare, and that thing there is a very large crater, the sort of thing we call a basin, and there's a smaller crater and so forth. But mare are the huge flows of basalt that make up the dark spots that you see when you look at the man in the moon. But this isn't the Earth's moon, and there is no way I'm going to start making dogmatic pronouncements from images of this resolution about the structure of a world whose very surface is made of different substances. But I will point out one thing, which is known from spectroscopic observations from Earth that were announced last October, and that is there is a very strange and puzzling inverse correlation between what the surfaces of these worlds are made of and what their insides are made of. I'm not talking about Io there. Io is just weird all the way around. It's the one that's made of rock, and that's a weird interior for a Jovian moon, and it's the one that has this surface of salt, and that's a weird surface. But the others all have surfaces in which there is frozen water, in other words, snow and ice, and rock. The rock is a rather darkish material, and it may be basalt and it may not. We're not sure. But the strange thing about this is that the more water they have on their insides, the less frozen water they have on their outsides. And so the increasing sequence of amount of water on the inside, whether it's liquid or frozen, is Europa, Ganymede, Callisto. That is the second, third, and fourth out from Jupiter. But Europa has a surface that is almost totally covered with frozen water. It's the one that has the least amount of it on the inside. Ganymede, which is more water than rock on the inside, has a surface that is only about half frozen water. And Callisto, the 3,000-mile snowball, the one that is made almost entirely of frozen water, in this case, on the inside, has an outside that is almost entirely rock. If there's any frozen water at all, we can't detect it from the Earth. We do not understand the reason for this inverse correlation. We may be able to find it out when we get these magnificently detailed pictures that we expect of all four of those moons from the Voyager spacecraft. I'll give you at least a suggestion, though, and the suggestion is this. As you decrease the amount of rock that is present inside the moon, you also decrease the amount of radioactive heat that it has. And if you decrease the amount of radioactive heat that it has, you decrease the opportunity that that moon ever had to melt and differentiate. That is to say, to become totally molten, separate itself out while it was molten, so the heaviest stuff fell to the middle and the lightest stuff floated to the top and formed a crust, and the other materials arranged themselves in between. The Earth has differentiated. It has a heavy iron core, it has the very lightest rocks in the crust, and it has rocks of intermediate and increasing densities all the way down between the crust and the core. The moon has also differentiated. So is Mars, so is Mercury, so is Venus. And so, apparently, have at least Io, Europa, and to some extent Ganymede, Callisto may not have been able to. And it may very well be, after all, water is going to be the lightest of the materials that make up these substances, these moons, right? Less so than water, less so than rock, certainly less so than iron. It may very well be that in the case of Callisto, what it is a pretty much homogeneously mixed planet of ice, yes, but ice mixed with just enough rocky material, perhaps in the form of dust grains, to make it a thoroughly dirty snowball. So that when we look at it spectroscopically from Earth, we do not see the ice on the outside. That may be particularly true since the ice might have gotten evaporated off preferentially from the very surfaces of these moons because of the sputtering which these moons too, of course, would encounter as a result of being inside Jupiter's radiation belt. In any case, you have this very strange inverse correlation. Let me tell you now, skipping one slide about Pioneer Jupiter,
These are the spacecraft. They were essentially identical except that 11 had one more magnetometer, which made most of these observations that I'm telling you about. And they were very wonderful spacecraft considering their simplicity. Remember, please, that they were supposed to send back data from 500 million miles from home. And to do that, you're going to need a pretty strong radio signal. And so what the spacecraft is, basically, is one big dish antenna, 9 feet in diameter, with everything else simply bolted to the back of it wherever it was convenient. You have radioactive power sources, radio thermal generators, which are out on the ends of booms so as to keep them away from the instruments which are trying to measure natural radiation there in the middle. You also have a magnetometer way out on the end of a long boom for the same reason. There are going to be magnetic fields associated with the spacecraft. But basically what you've got is just this enormous dish antenna. That antenna sent back the radio signals which transmitted all the data which I've been telling you, the pictures and everything else, to the Earth. But even so, despite the fact that the spacecraft was mostly an antenna, the strength of the signals received on the Earth from either of these spacecraft when they were sitting next to Jupiter was so weak that if the spacecraft had sat there next to Jupiter and continued transmitting at that signal strength, which was about a quadrillionth of a watt when it was received on the Earth, for the next 19 million years, and we saved up all of the energy that we had received for that 19 million years, at the end of 19 million years, you would have enough electricity to light a 7.5-watt Christmas tree bulb for a thousandth of a second. That was the intensity of the signals on which not only the pictures, but all of the other data from Pioneer 10 and 11 were sent back from Jupiter. And of course, okay, I'll go through my other slides very quickly. Of course, they did not sit next to Jupiter. Pioneer 10 is being thrown out of the solar system on that dashed orbit that you see there. Pioneer 11, and that's the famous plaque that they have to identify themselves. You've probably seen the design by this time with the picture of the man and the woman next to the spacecraft for scale, the spider diagram there that shows their position in the galaxy with respect to 14 pulsars, and the little diagram in the bottom which shows our solar system with the size of the planets, not to scale, but an indication of them in binary code underneath, and a little picture of what the spacecraft did, leaving the third planet and flying past the fifth and out into space. But you may not have seen the plaque itself. This is the real thing. Pioneer 11 flew much closer to Jupiter, 26,000 miles instead of 81,000, and that meant that as it passed Jupiter, for a brief period there, it was traveling faster than any spacecraft before it ever had, 54,000 miles an hour, which means that it was fast enough to go from here to Detroit in a little under 2 seconds, and across the United States in somewhat under 2 minutes. And at that speed, it was hurled out by Jupiter's gravity so rapidly that it traveled completely around the Sun, 180 degrees around. You'd have your ground tour line up then. But it was going sufficiently fast that 5 years later, on September 5th of 1979, Pioneer 11 will fly past Saturn. And it will become the first spacecraft to get there, assuming that it still operates, and there is every reason to think now that it will. It's certainly doing very, very well now. There was the option of flying it between the rings and the planet. And that could have been very dangerous, but it could also have been very scientifically productive. In fact, even if the spacecraft had been destroyed there, we would have gotten some valuable close-up observations of Saturn and its magnetic field, if any, on the way in, which might have compensated for the fact that you wouldn't have gotten anything on the way out. Furthermore, the spacecraft will be so near the end of any conceivable useful life that it might have because its radioactive generators are very rapidly running down, they're losing their radioactivity, that it seemed to me that it was worthwhile to take the very real risk of sacrificing the spacecraft and finding out what it is like interior to those rings. The Voyagers, which after all have the capability of observing Uranus and perhaps interstellar space beyond that, would not be risked in such a thing. They will go well outside the rings. Well, to my very deep disappointment, NASA has decided not to fly Pioneer 11 between the rings and Saturn, but to fly it outside, and furthermore, to fly it on exactly the same trajectory that Voyager 2 is going to take if it goes on to Uranus. Which means we not only lose any data that we would get interior to the rings, we also simply get the same data we're going to get from Voyager 2 anyway. This was done, of course, in the interest of safety. If it turns out it's not safe out there either, and that's entirely possible, Voyager 2's mission is going to be severely modified, and among other things, we're going to lose Uranus. But I am disheartened. I would rather they took a chance and went for broke and found out what happened. I'm sometimes accused of, it's obvious that I'm a supporter of space exploration. Occasionally, people who don't know me very well accuse me of being a blind supporter of it. Well, it's very seldom that I criticize NASA, because I have done an awful lot of thinking about an awful lot of things they've done, and almost always it turns out that, in fact, they've done the right thing. And, in fact, in cases where I thought they hadn't, for example, for a long time I cited Pioneer Venus as an example of a planetary mission we don't really need, it was because of my ignorance, not because they had made the wrong decision. Of course, it's their own fault that I was ignorant. It's because they make it so doggone hard to find out these things. You know, they ought to be publishing all this, and I ought to find it harder to make a living by telling people like you this information. Well, here's a good example, though, of something where I think NASA has made the wrong decision, and I, for one, am very unhappy about it. So, thank you very much, and I hope to see you again next month for Beyond Jupiter. And thank you. There are telescopes from Abrams Planetarium, or at least there is a telescope set up on the outside, unless I am badly mistaken, and Bob Victor there will tell us whether I am. Bob? And you will be able to see both Jupiter and Saturn through that telescope, over in front of Abrams Planetarium. If you have any questions, you got 10 minutes, so I noticed at least one hand there, and I wanted to end it at some humane hour, but please feel free to gather around, and I'll try to answer them for you. Opposite of our usual procedure, but this time I think it'll be all right. Can we have the projector down to fan, please? Just fan. We want to cool the lamp a bit.
Why can't you land right here on this side of it? Okay, you'll be out of all the particles coming in from behind here.
Yeah.
If you land here, you've got to be safe.
Let's say you're safest.
Okay.
Perhaps someday it will be done. It's not impossible to withstand those. Well, for a manned landing, I would not want to go through the belt at all. You know, for an unmanned landing, it's possible someday, and it might very well be worthwhile. But we don't know how hard that surface is, for one thing. You know, it's salt, and that's not rock. And good heavens, we didn't even know before we went to the moon with the surveyors whether a friendly, familiar rock surface. Okay, there. I get very nervous when people other than me handle my slides. I really wish. Okay, fine. I'm sorry, but you know these are my professional life, and many of them are literally impossible to. Okay, good. Where's the bottom of my slide box? There it is. So, you know, maybe someday, maybe, but that's why you have a flyby first, you know, because you don't know what, you're not going to go for a landing because you just don't know enough about it.
My understanding, I heard that, turning a ring inside the crater.
Yes.
And they're even suspecting that it may even go all the way to the cloud center here. Such being
well, it definitely does in the sense that there are particles in there. The question is how many.
Okay.
You know, where do you stop calling it a ring and start calling it an occasional meteoroid?
Well, be that as you have the situation where the ring does not go all the way to the cloud center. They certainly penetrate quite a ways in.
Mm-hmm.
And we're sort of having build a barrier. Now,
all you need is to get hit by one of those, and you're dead.
That's right.
Okay, in the first place, we don't know how many of those there are, and the only way you're ever going to find out is to send a spacecraft through there, and Pioneer 11 seems like the obvious one to risk, because it's going to be dead anyway very shortly. And not the Voyagers, and not something else which is expensive and more complex in the future. And secondly, there is also evidence of material outside the ring that we see, including at the distance where they're now planning to fly it past. So it seems to me what they should have done was try it out.
Have they considered a flyby?
Most of the Pioneer scientists, by the way, wanted to do that. They wanted to go between the rings and the planet. And they were overruled by NASA headquarters, which was thinking primarily in terms of Voyager.
Have they considered something like, if you have the this was Saturn, and it had the rings running around, had they considered like a intermediate latitude flyby, like flyby something on Jupiter?
You've got to cross the ring plane at some distance.
Oh, yeah, I want to. I'd love to catch it.
And, you know, because the ring plane is a great circle, and your orbit must be centered on the center of Saturn. So you got to cross the ring plane somewhere, and we just don't know any distance where we're certain that it's safe to do that. Another possibility would be to dive right through Cassini's gap.
Oh, that would be radioactive.
That'd be cute.
Radioactive material.
Yes.
That's why I have to do that one.
Right, correct.
I don't want to get to this.
There is very good evidence that exists, yes. We do not know how far down it goes. Well, we know, it's absolutely certain theoretically, that there must be some particles going all the way into the cloud tops. The question is how many. All you got to do is get hit by one. But if the chances against that are one in a million, then you probably are right. If they're one in two, then, you know, you want to avoid it. The only way to find that out is to send a spacecraft through. And the very fact that it got hit would tell you some important things about the nature of the rings. For example, they give you an idea of the average size of the particles. If the particles are big, then they are few and far between to give you observed brightness. So if you got hit, you know you got hit by something small. Either that or it was an incredible long shot, one or the other, and chances against that are, you know, smaller than chances.
There's a probabilistic sign.
Oh, I'm afraid it's good.
Exactly. Let's take a question from this side.
You said that it's possible for the planets all to line up. Why?
Yes. Because in the first place, their orbits are not all in the same plane, and in the second place, there are commensurabilities among their pyramids, too.
Which planets? Each planet has a different plane level.
Yes, and only Pluto. Pluto is the one that is blatantly, obviously different, but they're all slightly different. And you know, you get out there in the outer solar system where you're playing around with billions of miles, and you get a relative tilt of 1 degree, and you're talking in terms of an enormous distance, an enormous linear distance.
What was that second word you used? Something I don't even know what it was.
I don't know either.
In your answer to my first question, why they couldn't line up,
especially on Thursday.